Today's show is sponsored by Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for a free 30-day trial.
There's a reason it doesn't sound like the old media. That's because it's the new media. Dan Carlin, common sense.
I have several things that I'd like to try to get into a little bit today, and I don't know how deeply I'm going to go into them individually, but there's several stories that were of interest to me for sort of different reasons. You know me, I'll probably just drone on about the first one so long, we'll never get to the other. So I'm not promising I'll get to all of them, but there's a bunch of different things that were worth talking about, I thought. Let me start the program off by saying I know that we're at like a numerically significant period with today's show. It's show number 300, but I'm not much on anniversaries or commemorations or things like that. You know, I do have two thoughts that spring to my mind really quickly that might be worth just giving 1 second to, because I find them interesting. You know, as a fan of history, I'm always wondering what it would be like to live through certain events. And I keep trying to remind myself that there are events going on right now that we are living with. It would be really cool if you were looking back at this from 100 or 200 years from now, reading a book about what it was like to be in the new media, you know, over the last 10 or so years. Because as much as 300 shows sound significant to me, the bigger milestone in terms of, you know, not being able to almost believe it is the 10 plus years since we started doing this, and how much the whole new media thing has changed since we started. And of course, new media is a lot more than just podcasting. It's blogs and vlogs and everything else. And to have a ringside seat and being able to sort of see it from the inside, as many of you out there, because, you know, many of you are involved in the new media too, as many of you were able to see it too. Here we always wonder what it would be like to live through certain historical, you know, significant time periods and to really, you know, be there for it. And we have. It just may not seem like it. It seems a little banal, I guess, when you live through it. But if somebody writes a book in a year about this whole period and you read it and you go, yeah, I was there and I remember that. And you'll realize that you lived through a historically significant time. And when I think about the 300 shows, 10 plus years thing, I'm going, you know, I think we all knew that it was going to be big, this new media thing. I don't think you would have been doing it, you know, in 2005 if you couldn't see the potential. But that doesn't mean you have a specific idea of how the, you know, actual roadmap will go and which paths will be chosen and how it will take. And it's fascinating. And that's one of the things that I think about when I look today at the landscape and go, geez, 10 years. I mean, what's this going to be like in 20 years and 30 years? The other thing, of course, predictably, I know, is that I'm filled with gratitude. And that's you know, it's funny. It's one of those words that sounds like a daily affirmation, but I feel like I say it enough that it's become one. I'm still profoundly thankful that we're still here, still doing this, and that you folks haven't been, you know, completely driven off by the Martian, you know, ideas that I throw out here from time to time. Surely to upset everyone about these passionate topics you're supposed to avoid at the dinner table that are our stock in trade. And I have to say, I find it heartening that you can do that because it proves to me that there's some open-minded people out there, because if you just read the comments people make after news stories these days, you would think we're going to have some sort of civil war in the streets between right and left any day now. And since so many of my ideas, you know, hoping to get some sort of major reform that we all need to balance a out-of-whack system out, you know, requires people of different ideological, you know, belief system to sort of join hands and work on the same cause, some physical proof that people can be open-minded and listen to other people's beliefs and sort of factor that into their thinking and be broad-minded or open-minded in the most true sense of the word, that's heartening for me and makes me think that, okay, just these long-shot ideas that I have about reform aren't totally long-shot. At least the people are there to make it work, some of them. So thank you for everything, folks. You know, you sharing the show, you telling people about it, and of course your support. But that doesn't mean I don't want a gift. You thought I was going to say 300 shows and, you know, just thank you? 10 plus years and, you know, we'll just keep going. No, I want a gift, but I don't want it from you. I need it from something that's like the equivalent of the Tooth Fairy. Or the I Dream of Genie, something where you can just say, here's what I want for 10 plus years about talking about, you know, the political system in the U.S. and the problems with the two parties and corruption and all this. Here's what I want. I want Murphy's Law to come into play at the two presidential conventions coming up and in these two campaigns. Now, indulge me, if you will, for a second. This is fantasy here. I'm told it's healthy to have fantasies, and of course wouldn't mind be political. But if you're like me, and you enjoy, for example, although, you know, it's become a little bit more serious, but I said I enjoyed having these outsider political candidates, for example, because I felt like at the debates it kind of exposed some of the puppet strings and some of the stuff from behind the curtain that goes on that aren't always, you know, easy to spot. You know, they make people go off script and they throw wild cards into the thing. And if you don't think the system's particularly designed well right now, as I don't, you know, I look at that as something useful, right? The people get to see a little bit more obviously how it works. But of course, the next step from that would be to have, from the political party's viewpoint, worst case scenarios happen at the two conventions as the campaigns, you know, reach their crescendos. Now, normally the chances of that happening are probably like 1 in 1,000,000. But I happen to notice when the odds go down to something like 1 in 10,000, is it still, you know, likely to happen? No, of course not. It's still a long shot, but it's not the long shot it used to be. Do you realize, folks, for the first time ever, you can concoct relatively rational scenarios where both conventions get weird? And of course, the odds are even longer that they would both get weird. Maybe one gets weird, the other gets weird. But we haven't had a weird convention in a very long time. These party conventions where they nominate their presidential, you know, candidates for the general election are like coronations, usually. They're political stage-managed, you know, PR sessions that go on for days and are supported by taxpayers. It's meant to look like this is part of how the system is designed to work, right? We have these two big parties that are taxpayer-supported, and they handle the job of taking the will of the people and translating that into a candidate that then runs for president based on what the people of that party, you know, a large chunk of the country, decided. Now, that's an easy image to portray as long as it's never challenged and there hasn't been any decent challenging at political conventions, really, since the 1970s, and even that paled in comparison to what one might hope for. So this fantasy of mine involves the political parties having issues with what the electorate of their parties choose. Remember, part of this fantasy here is that somehow these two parties will then translate the will of Americans into candidates, but they don't even pretend to represent Americans. They represent Americans of that party. And I know that sounds obvious, but we're talking about, you know, maybe 30% of the population for the Democrats and maybe 30% of the population for the Republicans, something in that area, of which a large percentage don't agree with the rest of the party, and most of them don't vote, and, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot of things to it. But the bottom line is that these parties are kind of like private entities who come up with, you know, the candidate that they want, and this isn't necessarily required to be the candidate that the people who, you know, vote for, and I think we forget that. I would like to see us reminded. It would create a wonderful level of chaos, but it would show the strings again. If I thought having outsiders at the political debates, for example, expose some of the behind-the-curtain stuff, what do you think it would be like? I'm just thinking of the Gore-Bush election in 2000 and how it would be like that on steroids. What would it be like if one of the parties or both of the parties chose the candidate who didn't get the most votes in the primaries, you know, in the other statewide elections? Now, I know there's a percentage of you that don't even know that this can happen. And listen, if you're from outside the United States, our system is pretty much as arcane as yours, maybe more so, depending on where you're from. And there are safeguards built into it. Safeguard number one is both parties can sway an election in the direction that they want it to go by convention time if they have to. I mention if they have to because this is the kind of tool that if they don't have to is not employed at all.
because the best way to keep it fresh and useful is not to use it very much, because if you use it very much, people get wise to it. The preference is to not use it at all, but sometimes the pesky voters do things that are not good for the party. And again, the problem here is assuming that they are one and the same. There was a wonderful piece I remember back in 2008 that former vice presidential candidate Geraldine Ferraro penned. She was one of the people that helped design what the media calls a superdelegate. A superdelegate is one of the tools that both parties essentially use to make sure, I guess you could call it, that they have some electoral ballast, you know, in their party. People who will keep it grounded, keep it from tacking too much in the direction of one side or the other. Superdelegates are delegates who can vote for anyone they want to at the convention. Most delegates can't. Most delegates, you know, are chosen as part of their state, and the state decides who they want. It's more complicated than this, but who they want or a percentage of who they want, then they send a voter to the convention who represents the will of those people and is usually legally required to vote for, you know, the stated person. So if it's Bernie Sanders in Vermont, the delegate shows up to vote for Bernie Sanders, but the superdelegate can vote for anyone they want to. Superdelegates are basically the establishment, the party establishment, the elected officials from the party, both in, you know, public jobs and in party jobs. You know, the state representatives of the party. I mean, this is the party faithful. And they control about 20% of, you know, the ballots at these conventions. In other words, they can sway an election one way or the other if it's not a total landslide. The Republicans have something similar in their party, where a significant percentage of the party establishment is able to cast ballots in a way that will sway an election one way or the other. Again, no one wants to use this if they don't have to. But the time you use it is when you feel like you're facing some sort of disaster for the party. If you go look at the history, by the way, of the superdelegates, as they're called, you can see that they arose out of a need the parties felt to keep the nominations out of the hands of the public when the public was in the mood to nominate people who were too much outsiders or too likely to get their clock cleaned in the general election. As I said, Geraldine Ferraro penned a very interesting defense of the idea of the superdelegate. And if I can remember, I looked it up the other day. We'll link to it in the show notes. She essentially said something to the effect of, you know, you have to understand, this is our party. We have a right to protect it. What if people just sign up, you know, 3 months before the election happens and they sign up for the party? I mean, are these really Democrats? We are really Democrats, the people who have been here for years working for the party, you know, running for office for the party. And we're the ones who should be able to say, you know, what did she say? Lead. She said, our job as superdelegates is to lead. So if Bernie Sanders came in to the Democratic, you know, convention, shocking the world, right, up on Hillary Clinton, I think his money-raising tallies have been, you know, good enough. I don't know if they're comparable, but they're good enough to compete. So what if he gains some momentum? Let's remember 2008 is a wonderful reminder that, you know, when Hillary Clinton's on the campaign trail, that doesn't necessarily turn voters on everywhere. I mean, you know, if and Sanders is the, you know, he's not exactly this charismatic, you know, Obama had something really going for him on the campaign trail. He's a hell of a campaigner. But what if by hook or by crook, some momentum happens and Bernie Sanders, you know, goes into the convention ahead, but not by much. It's tight. This is when you wonder about superdelegates. If they could vote in a way where, you know, still a minority of them voted for Bernie Sanders, but enough of them, enough of the 20% of the ballot holders who are the party electoral ballast, if enough of them vote the other way, then the people could have decided on Bernie Sanders, the Democratic voters, but the party decided they don't want Bernie Sanders. If you go read that article from 2008, Ferraro basically says the same thing about recent Democratic converts, that they shouldn't control, you know, who the party picks over long-term members. You know, what are those same people who hold those same ideas going to think about a guy who wants to be the party's nominee, who is a senator, who is not even from their party? right? You talk about a recent convert. He's running as a Democrat basically because the way the system is set up, you can't win if you're not a Republican or a Democrat. Does that mean the Democrats are going to look at him in a close race and go, yeah, we'd rather have the guy who was an independent recently and who only became a Democrat, you know, to use our structure to run for president than the person who's basically the establishment in the Democratic Party, Bill and Hillary Clinton? Come on. The question is how much would the party be willing to fudge to do that? Nobody's willing to go the extreme route and have, you know, Hillary way behind Bernie Sanders and then the superdelegates make up all the ground. I think there'd be, I don't know what there would be. It would be insane. But there's somewhere where the fudge factor is not too large that I think the party be willing to go to protect, you know, the establishment here, the invoking of the electoral ballast to make sure that the Democratic Party was not nominating a guy who was really not a member of the Democratic Party inside. Especially over an establishment candidate that would give them, you know, the first woman president. At the same time, you know, she is the Democratic Party establishment. She's very ensconced. She is a strong candidate with lots of money and would look good against whomever the Republicans could nominate. Those are exactly the kind of argument Geraldine Ferraro was putting forward in that article. This is why the party made sure that there was some way to offset the bad decision of the electorate during those times when they made bad decisions. Now, again, if you are raised to think that we live in a two-party system and that the two parties are part of the constitutional design, you know, to elicit what the people want in terms of whom they want on the, you know, final ballots to vote for, you would think this is outrageous that these people control the will of the people like this. But that's because we forget that that's not what they are. There were no parties when this country was founded. The Federalist Papers have arguments between founding fathers talking about the danger of what they called factions. Now, maybe political parties became inevitable at some point, but what we have now have welded themselves, the two big parties, to the system in such a way that they've made themselves indispensable, and they've made themselves the arbiters. And this is a long-standing thing. It just becomes tighter like a boa constrictor squeeze all the time. But, I mean, it's been this way for a very long time. But now it's like inseparable from the system. So now you could almost make the case that they have become the de facto way that people elicit who they want on the national ballot, but they're still a private entity that can still control these things and then justify it by saying, listen, we look out for our interest. We're not here as a vehicle for constitutional government other than, you know, when they vote for, you know, our representatives. We want your votes. We just don't want you to necessarily decide who you get to vote for. That's our prerogative. It's our party. The parties are very inclusive when they want votes for their candidates, but they tend to be very protective when it's about, you know, asserting how the party is structured and how it's organized and, you know, who gets to pick who the candidates are. In other words, nobody wants some outsider controlling a party that, you know, you've worked hard for and believe in and helped mold. Nobody wants that. At the same time, then, let's stop pretending that these are, you know, parts of the structure, because these seriously need reform if they are. But if they're not, then they're too powerful. Then they have too much control over the way things are. So how do you fix that? Well, it's very hard to break a stranglehold of a system that's been, you know, constricting ever so tightly for 100 years, 150 years, I mean. But there are ways to remind people about the artificial nature of them. And one way would be for them to overturn or go against the will of the people. Now, I concoct that strategy because that's actually the harder to imagine. The Republicans are in such a quandary that there have been, you know, columns in like the New York Times and the Washington Post by old line party faithful basically saying, we don't care how you do it, GOP, dump Trump. He's destroying the party. He's destroying the brand. We'll never recover from this. When you have people writing that, you know, for publication, well, then it's out there. I mean, the party can almost say that they were doing the bidding of everyone who's ever supported them by getting rid of Trump by hook or by crook. The only problem is the people that are tending to support Trump now are the ones who already think the party's been screwing them election after election after election, getting their votes based on, you know, this agenda that they never enact because, let's be honest, they don't really share it. They may speak the language of Middle America and, you know, the West and Idaho and all these places that appeal, you know, to the kinds of values that they throw out there, but they have values that are much more the corporate Wall Street side of the Republican Party, which has always been there too. And slowly but surely, the people wake up to that. And when they support any candidate that Washington hates, well, you begin to see the sort of divide that that electoral ballast both parties have is designed to, you know, balance out. You nominate Trump, they're going to try to figure out a way to derail that for the good of the party. Now, Trump knows this, by the way, which is why he's using as a sort of a, you know, Trump card, if you'll pardon the pun, the potential to go and run as an independent, you know, with a lot of money. One of those rare Ross Perot type independents that is dangerous enough with the amount of money they have that they can partially make up for the lack of party structure and the last minute starts and moves and whatnot. You can make up for a lot of mistakes and a lot of lost time, politically speaking, you know, with cash. Now, Trump would probably not win as an independent, and I think he knows this. I think if he thought he would, maybe he would have started out running as one. But he can destroy the Republican chances of winning for sure in the next election by doing so. So he's basically saying, you can take a chance of winning with me and then getting me and whatever policies I'm going to put forward. All we know is he's going to do these big things. He's going to be tough. He's going to win. But we don't know the specifics. It's Nixon's secret plan to end the Vietnam War, but on every policy. Or you can watch me go independent and I'll screw both of us. It's the Samson option, right? He's going to tear down the building and have every pillar fall on the Republican Party at the same time. And oh yeah, finally sever ties with all those people that were going to vote for Trump anyway, because they already think the party's not working for them. What happens when they finally get their candidate that they're sure will not work for the Republican Party establishment, and the Republican Party establishment, you know, scotches it with their version of superdelegates? Well, it won't happen if Trump continues the kind of lead he has now. Even with all the superdelegates voting the other way, I don't think they could overcome the kind of lead he's pulling right now. But it makes for a potentially really fun convention. You know, I feel a little guilty rooting for chaos as a reform tool. At the same time, I try to remember, as I've said in this program many times, these parties are not the country, folks. We associate them with the country because the branding of both those parties would like it to be that way. But that gives us sort of a, you know, wrong-headed view of them. Their interests sometimes dovetail with the interests of voters. It's when they don't that things could get interesting. And my fantasy is that this year, the voters of both parties, you know, who are operating under the same sorts of trends, I mean, the same people that are angry at the Republican Party establishment and are pushing for a Trump are a lot of the same people that are angry with the Democratic Party establishment and are pushing for Sanders, right? These people who are mad enough to push anti-establishment candidates are at some point, if they are successful, run smack dab into the wall of that establishment. Who's going to push back with what tools they have? The tools they have are things like superdelegates. And that would come into play at conventions, and it would come into play if the insurgent candidates were winning, especially if they weren't winning by much. So a 1 in a million chance normally becomes a 1 in a 10,000 chance, and you know, sometimes when the odds are that low, I might even buy a lottery ticket. That's how you know it's a fantasy, by the way, when you're trying to talk up a 1 in 10,000 chance as a much, you know, improved situation, right? I like those odds, only when compared to 1 in a million. I always try to tell myself, though, you know, one person's impossible long shot is another person's historical wild card. They happen. Why not for me? Welcome to Fantasy Island. In any case, the next story I wanted to talk about is something that in terms of discussions we've had before, but it's actually come up in the news again because the president is currently talking about using his executive authority to make what his supporters would consider to be progress on some issues. And he's been threatening to do this for a long time. So an article came out that I wanted to talk about. And then since the article came out,
the president's people got a little bit more specific of some of the areas he's considering using executive authority to sort of get around the need to deal with Congress. And before we talk about this, let's just understand that this is another one of these trends that's been continuing for a while. We've talked about it for years. I mean, remember the conversations we used to have about George W. Bush and signing statements, where he'd sign these laws to get these bills passed, but basically write, you know, a disclaimer at the bottom. We may or may not agree with the interpretation. I mean, a loophole, an official loophole, using something that was much more of a way to make statements in the past in a way that was much more geared towards, you know, having some legal help in the White House going, let me tell you how you do that, you do blah, 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 right? It's the same kind of people giving the president advice now, saying, listen, you don't have to wait, you know, for Congress on this gun issue. They're bought, they're paid for, they're never going to vote the right way, and the American people are demanding progress, and you'll get a lot of credit for it. Just go around them. They do it, which is probably true, which is part of the problem. We have a dynamic here in the country where we, the electorate, encourage our leaders to be more and more dismissive of the idea that we have a government based on a separation of powers, right? It's a key phrase. Whereas the two parties might not be in the Constitution, phrase-wise, the separation of powers is. The idea of the separation of powers is pretty much the whole basic idea. But the dynamic over time has been pretty consistently for the chief executive, the president, to assume more authority at the expense mostly of the Congress. This has not always been a one-way situation. It's more like a stock market that has gone broadly up over time, but occasionally has downticks. I mean, look at the period during Watergate and right after the leaving of the White House by Richard Nixon. You have an uptick in congressional power and authority, but the long-term trend is for Congress's power to have diminished greatly since the founding of the country and the chief executive to have grown. How far do you want to allow that to happen, ladies and gentlemen? I mean, it's a logical question. It'd be fun if some of the presidential candidates would be asked something like that and then give an answer that they actually believed as opposed to one that they thought you wanted to hear, because it completely contradicts the idea of a president who can get things done, right? If you ask presidential hopefuls at one of these debates we've been watching and say something like, how much will you limit your ability to get things done unilaterally because it's bad for the constitutional design of the country? That's a heck of a quandary to put someone in, isn't it? And no president actually wants to find themselves in that position. So the current occasion of this story coming up that first got my attention was a nice piece in the Washington Post by Jonathan Turley, who's a famed, you know, legal scholar, and you see him all over the place. I like his stuff because he tends to defend the kinds of issues, you know, that I feel strongly about. Isn't that how we always judge these things? But this piece was about, you know, suggesting to President Obama that he might not want to use this authority and that Democrats might not want to cheer him for doing it, because very soon the people who hold that same power that he's sort of enhancing, like I said, this has been going on for a long time. These presidents, like the last one and the current one, they push it farther. And he's warning Democrats to be very careful because this new power will outlast him, which is always the problem with these things, right? The people that you like leave office. The people who are doing things that you're fine with these powers being used for, this executive authority, will go away someday and be replaced by people who want to do things that you can't believe, that make your stomach turn, right? As some of the things the president might want to do make some other people's stomach turn. But I mean, when you get your person in power, you want to use these powers. When the other guy gets in office or the other woman gets in office and wants to overturn things that are very important to you, what are you going to say when they use that same power and authority to do that? This is this wonderful little trade-off where you want to hear the presidential hopeful at the campaign say, listen, I want to do a ton, you know, to push our values. At the same time, let's recognize that there's a danger to the system if we do this in a way that then changes the balance of powers and weakens some of our safeguards. So this Jonathan Turley piece was reprinted all over the place. It was in my local paper, the Register Guard, on Sunday, December 20th, 2015, probably in the Post the day before, I would assume. Headlined in my local paper, and your headline may differ, next president could follow Obama's lead. So Turley starts off talking about Trump, and Trump is sort of the boogeyman in this article.
So every time he's trying to warn Democrats not to essentially reward the president for expanding the executive powers, he's pointing out that those executive powers, in a worst-case scenario to a lot of Democrats, could land in Trump's lap. Right? Be careful about the powers you give the president. They could go straight to Trump, is what he's saying in a nutshell. So he talks about Trump and his executive sort of style about getting things done, and then says, quote, "But if Democrats are alarmed by this glimpse into a Trump administration, they are in part to blame. They have supported President Obama's claims of unchecked authority in a variety of areas, particularly immigration, and Obama's model will be attractive to successors who, while they may have a different agenda, have the same appetite for unilateral decisions. Obama," he writes, "has used his willingness to go it alone as a Democratic rallying cry." Now he's quoting the president from a speech. "We can't wait for an increasingly dysfunctional Congress to do its job. Where it won't act, I will." Turley says he told supporters in 2011. In his 2013 State of the Union address, Turley says, his similar line, "If Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will," Turley says, was met with ecstatic applause from the Democratic side of the chamber. End quote. He then goes on to point that President George W. Bush used this sort of power a lot too and was criticized for it. He says about President Obama's desire to do this, quote, "Thrilled by those changes, supporters have ignored the obvious danger that they could be planting a deep, unfortunate precedent that if the next president proves to be a Cruz rather than a Clinton, while the policies may not carry over to the next president, the powers will," end quote. Now, we've talked about this extensively. It's kind of a dynamic, isn't it? It's kind of a natural sort of thing that just kind of happens. And I think the people who founded this country assumed that the powers would be more jealously guarded because people tend to do that. They tend to be jealous. And for a long time, I think that that sort of seemed like the way it was. And Congress was pretty darn muscular in resisting encroachments on their authority. But over time, and little by little, and in part as a result of some of the corruption in the government, the reasons that Congress would care started to go away. And the idea of avoiding responsibility for policy seemed like a much better idea than, you know, fighting over who should have the responsibility for the policies. I mean, you look at the Declaration of War as a perfect example. Congress, in their own minds, got a good deal by ceding that authority to presidents long ago. They don't have to put their John Hancock on the decision unless they want to. It's not my fault. Or, I always supported the war, depending on how it turns out. And at the same time, I don't think that they feel like they miss that much. So slowly but surely, this dynamic happens where the presidents start using their authority more and more, you know, to push the agenda that their supporters want. And it looks great to their supporters because they like the goal, but they don't see, you know, the forest for the trees and realize that then their champion is going to be gone and that power is going to be in the hands of someone else. Case in point, one of the things that President Obama has said in the last week, or his supporters have, has to do with some sort of unilateral executive authority action on guns. Now, the ideas they're floating appear to someone like yours truly to be relatively understandable. I mean, I'm not a fanatic, and they want to keep the guns out of hands of people who shouldn't have them, people who are already prohibited, but there are these loopholes. I understand why you'd go against that. I don't have any problem with that. I don't think that that threatens the Second Amendment, right? Or this idea, even if you're a person who believes that the Second Amendment, you know, supports individual firearm ownership, that closing a loophole of individual gun sales. I mean, to me, that doesn't seem like the sky is falling. Not totally onerous, but the method that the president is using to achieve this is something that not only the other side will use and then justify by saying, listen, Obama did it with guns, but that is really avoiding the truth of the matter, which is that it's not the law of the land in any way that's meaningful. And Donald Trump has already proven this. I think he must have read the Jonathan Turley piece. He came out the other day and said that if President Obama pulls an executive action on guns and then Trump wins the White House, he'll immediately overturn it. I got this story off the CNN website, posted on January 2nd, 2016, headlined, quote, "Trump, I will unsign Obama executive action on gun control," end quote.
from the beginning of the piece. Quote, Donald Trump on Saturday vowed to unsign President Obama's plans to tighten gun control via executive action, telling a packed rally in Biloxi, Mississippi, that he would protect the right to bear arms. Quote, there's an assault on the Second Amendment. You know Obama's going to do an executive order and really knock the hell out of it, Trump said. You know, the system's supposed to be, you get the Democrats, you get the Republicans, and you make deals. He can't do that. He can't do that. So he's going to sign another executive order having to do with the Second Amendment, having to do with guns. I will veto. I will unsign that so fast. End quote. So see, even that moment where you can cheer on the president for pushing something that you think is a life or death issue that the other side, for all sorts of, you know, reasons, has been stymieing, you can't feel good about it because it won't hold up, because the next guy in office, if he is the next guy in office, can reverse it with the snap of a finger. Congress might be really hard to get on board with certain things, but once they are, generally, it sticks. Once you start making law by executive fiat, what happens when the executive changes? And, you know, it's part of, and we've talked about this before, when people say to me, where do you see the United States going? One of the things I often say, because I think it makes some sense, is that we may be charting into territory, you know, that's never been traveled before in terms of political systems. I think we are led to believe, and yours truly too. I took a ton of political science classes, and you open up those books and they tell you the types of governments that there are. There are democracies and there are republics and there are dictatorships. And, you know, we all understand that those forms have been around a long time. But I think we make an assumption that those are the only forms there will ever be, that they've invented all the kinds of systems broadly that you might have. And I think I've used this exact example before, but I used to play a game, one of the versions of Civilization used to have future types of government, an ecotopia, or, you know, they had all these different governments that have never existed before, but that you could consciously imagine evolving. And I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, 500 years from now, they look back and describe the system that the United States is in transition towards as something completely new. Unprecedented. I'm reminded of an article someone wrote once where they said, and this is 5-8 years ago, where they said the United States is evolving into a dictatorship where the rule in office changes. Now, we're nowhere near there right now, obviously, but if you wanted to talk about long-term transitions and this executive authority growing and growing and growing, could you argue that you have a temporary dictatorship that every 4 or 8 years voters can overturn if the superdelegates don't speak too loudly? Have you ever heard of a system like that? I mean, I'm sure there are examples, but none come readily to mind. Would you like a system like that? All the power of a dictator, but freely elected and, you know, drummed out of office in 4 or 8 years? I mean, like I said, I imagine that there would be a lot of people out there that, especially when they're really angry at Congress or dysfunctional government, might call that an improvement. But for a supporter of the old republic like yours truly, I get a weird feeling in my stomach when I even think about that. Now, here's the question that's worth asking, though. Even if people on a higher level understood the danger to the system that we, you know, create when we use these executive actions, could they rise above it and support a candidate who, when asked about something as important, for example, to Democratic voters as gun control, or to Republican voters as something as important as preserving the freedom to use guns, could you imagine a candidate, you know, telling the audience and being supported for telling the audience when they say, what will you do about this? They say something like, well, I'll do everything constitutionally within my rights, but one thing I'm not going to do is push the envelope here and do this by executive action, because I think it would be bad for the country if I tried to push our agenda so far that it hurt the structures of the country. You think somebody running for office would be rewarded for saying that they'd like to protect the Constitution, even at the expense of making progress on a much-loved pet issue? I don't know. But I think that that right there accounts for the dynamic about why we're going in this direction, because I think everything sort of encourages more and more of this idea that what this country really needs is a person in the top job who can get things done and the power in the top job that allows them to, without worrying about what this dysfunctional Congress and this out-of-touch judiciary wants.
See how easy it is to make that sound like a good thing? Anyway. The segment you just heard was recorded yesterday. In between then and now, news has broken on this story that needs to be included as part of sort of an addendum or a tag, if you will. I get listeners who want me to go back and do that with shows. You know, years ago, I heard an error in show 124, Dan. I would appreciate it if you would go fix that. And you want to say, well, listen, it's a little like, you know, a watercolor or a painting or something. You know, you can't really do that very easily, if at all. But if the show hasn't come out yet, we can add an addendum or a tag or something. And so since the recording yesterday, of course, the Obama administration has released the specifics of what they'd like to do on this gun question, you know, the executive authority overreach thing. And in a way that's rather interesting also, the specifics are, I'm going to quote a Republican who was talking, I think it was to the USA Today, about their reaction to this, underwhelming. Now, when you're worried about something like executive overreach, underwhelming is good, right? This is a positive thing in my mind. But it's interesting how it must have come about. First of all, let's understand that yesterday and the day before, this was a big issue nationally being written about from a lot of places, and the perspective was that the president was going to use this executive authority in a way that would be meaningful, where you would see some change that the people in Congress who are lobbying for the NRA and whatnot would be really upset about. And then it comes out late yesterday, and it's nothing like that. Very lightweight stuff, very light touch, a little bit more, you know, of linking disability records with gun checks, more money for this, recommendations for that. You know, by and large, compared to what everyone was expecting, very modest. And, well, let's be honest, you could say, I mean, another Republican called it a distraction. Now, these are people who normally would consider any teeny tiny imposition to be, you know, a constitutional disaster. If they're calling it a distraction, it's really kind of small and inoffensive sort of stuff from an executive authority standpoint. So here's what's worth asking, folks. Knowing how news gets done, what the heck happened? Because here's the way these news organizations got to talking about this subject to begin with. Sources inside the White House must have told them, probably multiple sources, because it's not like one source tells the New York Times something and then everything just copies that. There are multiple people inside the administration who either, you know, not on purpose, without the administration's official consent, or with the administration's official consent, you know, told the media that this is what the Obama administration's thinking about. In other words, what might have happened here is that the administration might have floated a trial balloon. This happens all the time, by the way. Sort of a little leak of a story saying, you know, the administration's considering doing this, and then see what happens, right? Gauge the reaction a little bit without having committed to the deal so that you could turn around later if it's this, you know, unmitigated disaster and say, I don't know where you got that story from. The president was never considering a total gun ban. I mean, all he was going to talk about was light recommendations on disabled gun check buy. I mean, there's a lot of good reasons why you might want to float a trial balloon. And when the entire media is essentially fooled like this, one questions whether or not a change wasn't made after the reaction was seen. And this is alluded to in some of the stories. I have one here from just a couple of hours ago, the January 6, 2016 online edition of the USA Today by Gregory Court, headlined, Chastened by Immigration, Obama Shows Restraint on Guns. So this is from a couple hours ago, Dateline, Washington. Quote, as executive actions go, President Obama's effort to clamp down on illegal gun sales was relatively restrained. The actions contain no executive orders, the best known and most formal exercise of unilateral presidential authority, only a presidential memorandum asking federal agencies to study smart gun technology. He proposed only one new regulation, a Social Security Administration rule that would allow it to share lists of people on disability with the National Background Check System. And the centerpiece of the initiative, the author says, was the issuing of a guidance document on which gun sales require a federal firearms license and therefore subject to a criminal background check. He says the document mostly restates existing case law and breaks no new legal ground. He says for all the predictions of executive orders exceeding the president's authority, Obama's actions generally colored within the lines. End quote.
And part of the reason for the muted response is everyone had sort of been led to believe this was going to be significant. And so when it comes in at, you know, one quarter the size people expected, even Republicans are going, I mean, one of the quotes was that one of them called it a distraction. These are the same people that are ready to file lawsuits. So if they're calling it a distraction, well, it's nowhere near as tough as everyone was led to believe. But who led the press to believe it? Again, they don't just make this stuff up. They're getting, you know, fed the information from sources. Seems to me somebody wanted to see, you know, how far the president might be able to go on this and, you know, how much pushback he'd get. And the story suggests, as the Jonathan Turley legal expert had said in the piece we just did, that being chastened on his executive authority on immigration might have had something to do with it. Because remember, just because a president uses the executive authority doesn't mean a lawsuit can't challenge it, and the president was challenged by lawsuits on that. But also the story points out, you know, what we talked about in that segment we recorded yesterday, that candidates like Donald Trump were promising to overturn the executive authority, you know, the minute upon taking office, which sort of undercuts the value of it, right? And sort of highlights the lack of staying power, if you will, while giving a Republican candidate, you know, something to make hay with. So maybe the trial balloon that was floated pointed out that, oh boy, this is really going to help Republicans in 2016, give them something they can play with and slam Democrats and Hillary with. So let's not go there right now. Not good for the 2016 electoral race. Even in the USA Today piece by Gregory Court, at the end, they speculate, as with many of the other articles I was reading on this, on what it was that played into the change. I mean, if we were sort of given a heads up for one thing and you get another, what played a role? Well, immigration and the reaction on the Republican side to that, lawsuits and whatnot, the same thing Jonathan Turley had mentioned as overreach in the segment we just did. But also newer stuff. I mean, the Gregory Court article quotes the press secretary, the Obama press secretary, you know, essentially mentioning what we said about Trump a second ago, that he might just overturn an executive order with another executive order. And he'd have a campaign issue that resonated with some people. Do we really want to go there? The end of the Gregory Court article says, quote, "And as Obama enters the final year of his presidency, the White House is also increasingly aware that executive action can be fleeting. Republican presidential candidates have already threatened to repeal Obama's actions." Now quoting the White House press secretary, quote, "A congressional action, a piece of legislation would be more effective. It couldn't just be reversed by the next president." End quote. That sounds to me like a direct response to Republican GOP candidates suggesting that that's exactly what they would do. So fascinating. Maybe a trial balloon. Maybe the media just all got it wrong. But let's remember where they get their information from. Somebody in the White House is telling them. So you have to ask yourself, okay, why was one course of action, you know, assumed and another adopted? But I'm not complaining. This is the result I would like to see. I don't want to see executive action. I think the president is smart to use it as little as possible and not give the next person in office, you know, another brick in the precedent wall to assert when they want to do something. So kudos to the president for not overreaching here. Or if you want to say he overreached by doing anything, then not overreaching much. Finally, this last thing that I want to get into, I'm going to try to weave some of what we talked about in the last show with something that's ongoing right now, a breaking news story from right here in my neck of the woods, by the way. If you recall the last show, we talked about sort of bad thoughts, for lack of a better word, and how so many of our intractable problems today revolve around what you might call wrong-headed thinking. Right. And that last show was done in the wake of the not that long ago San Bernardino terror attacks. And so soon after the story, there was a lot of focus on what was called at the time self-radicalization. The idea that normal, law-abiding Americans could be going about their daily business and get slowly sucked into, you know, radical propaganda the way one might get sucked into a drug addiction. And eventually you get turned into like a Manchurian candidate who attack your own people and, you know, create domestic terror attacks and whatnot. And since we did that show, a couple of interesting articles have appeared, one in particular that I wish I had had for the show, because it would have given me some interesting ammunition to use, discussing, you know, ideas that are out there being proposed by legal thinkers
about how you might combat something like that, and that we maybe need to change our entire attitude toward when things become actionable. And we talked about this in the last episode, right? Must you wait for the traditional line in the sand to be crossed that separates thought from action before you move? Must you wait for the 9/11 attacks to happen? Or can you go after the people that begin talking about doing something like that, right? And the obvious slippery slope arguments connected with that. As we said in the last show, I believe, you know, everyone has the freedom to think however they want. It's when you act on it that things become problematic or actionable. You can be a Nazi in your head, but you can't throw, you know, bricks through the front of a Jewish store. So Eric Eckholm, at the end of December 2015, writes an interesting piece in the New York Times where he talks about this incitement on the internet, the propaganda, the recruiting, the radicalization that goes on, and how the internet is used as a tool, as we all understand, right? It's a communications tool in large part. And, well, what happens if you communicate bad thoughts to people who then adopt the bad thoughts themselves? If we want to connect it, as we have in several history shows, to an intellectual contagion, is it logical to suggest that maybe a quarantine is in order? So let me read you a little of this piece. And like I said, I'm going to dovetail it into something that's a lot more problematic. The headlines in each newspaper differ. In my newspaper, the headline is, ISIS incitement on internet raises free speech questions. From the beginning of the piece, quote, "It is one of the most hallowed precepts in modern constitutional law. Freedom of speech may not be curbed unless it poses a clear and present danger, an actual imminent threat, not the mere advocacy of harmful acts or ideas. But in response to the Islamic State's success in grooming jihadis over the internet, some legal scholars are asking whether it is time to reconsider that constitutional line in the sand." End quote. Eckholm then goes on to point out that politicians on the campaign trail are essentially promising to get tough on the spread of, you know, radical jihadist sentiment, the propaganda. He writes, quote, "Appeals for tougher responses to the Islamic State's online recruiting efforts have, not surprisingly, emerged from the political realm. Donald Trump said the government should call on Bill Gates and others to somehow close off dangerous internet sites. He called First Amendment concerns foolish. Hillary Clinton, the article says, said the government should work with host companies to shut jihadi websites and chat rooms." End quote. Well, this sounds like logic, you know, to a certain point, right? You say to yourself, well, if there's, you know, jihadirecruitment.net or beheadtheinfidel.org, or we're talking about the Twitter account of the ISIS, you know, head hacker, Jihadi John with his 5,000 followers. If you're talking about removing that stuff, most people are going to go, yeah, get that stuff off of there. That stuff doesn't need to be on there. The problem, of course, comes when you start talking about not so easy to target big entities, and you start talking about what you do about, you know, grassroots people who are spreading the propaganda, which, by the way, happens already. I mean, legal experts will point out that this radicalization type stuff happens person to person in chat rooms that are not even connected to Islamic issues. You could have some kid on Twitter who's mostly talking about his favorite Atlanta Hawks basketball player, but every now and then slips in something like, by the way, I think my interpretation of my religion says that, you know, adulterous women should be stoned to death. I mean, is that guy crossing the line? Is he spreading information that could radicalize someone else? Does it matter how many tweets he has about that subject or how many followers he has? I mean, where do you draw the line on this stuff? You have to start dealing with the, you know, grassroots. You can't just target the big entities. Most of us would go, oh, yeah, I could see getting rid of beheadtheinfidel.org. In his article, Eric Eckholm quotes several legal experts of differing opinions on this, by the way. Several said that it was a slippery slope that could lead to bad things, the same thing, you know, yours truly would say. But some were pointing out, you know, that this is stuff we should be thinking about in a 21st century world with different challenges. As one law professor says, Eric Posner, professor of law at the University of Chicago, told Slate magazine, quote, "Never before in our history have enemies outside the United States been able to propagate genuinely dangerous ideas on American territory in such an effective way." The story says, quote, "The Islamic State's ability to spread," now quoting Posner, quote, ideas that lead directly to terrorist attacks, calls for new thinking about limits on freedom of speech. End quote. And as we said, it's one thing to talk about getting rid of these giant entities that may be spreading in ISIS.org, but it's a different thing once you get down to the level where, you know, one person is spreading links to another person that might radicalize them. This is what the law professor says, quote, Posner's proposal would make it illegal to go onto websites that glorify the Islamic State or support its recruitment or to distribute links to such sites. He would impose graduated penalties, starting with a warning letter, then fines or prison for repeat offenders, to convey that, quote, looking at ISIS-related websites, like looking at websites that display child pornography, is strictly forbidden, end quote. So treating Islamic radical propaganda, violent jihadist propaganda, the same way you would treat child porn is this person's example of how we might go about quarantining or limiting the impact of this kind of radicalizing propaganda, right? How do you deal with self-radicalization? You make it like child porn. Once again, I think we can get sucked into this idea because we think something along the lines of, well, since I never look at child porn or Islamic fundamentalist terrorist literature, why not? Which brings me to the other story, which I think, you know, strikes a little bit more close to home. Maybe not very close to home, but a little bit more close to home. In the last show, when we talked about the war on bad thoughts, you know, I threw out there, because I figured you could see it without me telling you, the fact that, you know, eventually you could apply a lot of this same sort of thinking to things like Christianity and more American-type philosophies, right? I mean, we are not immune in our own system from a radical fringe that cites the same things that we all cite as part of our birthright, but draws a more radical conclusion from them in the same way that most Islamic folks, you know, are peaceful people who read the Quran and follow the religion. But there's also a fringe on the edge that's much more violent, reads the same book, speaks the same language, but reacts in a much more brutal, bloody way, right? We have that in this country, too. We have people who have killed for the Constitution and killed for the Bible. And, well, we are, let's admit it, the products in this country, and we celebrate it once a year, of sedition, revolution, and yes, as the mother country would have described it, terrorism. Of course, we were not sawing the heads off of our, you know, British soldier occupiers. It was a genteel revolution, as it's often called. Nonetheless, all those guys who signed the Declaration of Independence could have been hung for treason. And when you have, as part of your makeup, and you celebrate these ideas of rebellion against tyranny, there are going to be people who take those ideas and use them to radicalize, you know, people for a cause. Take, for example, the 1 to 2 dozen people, the stories I have in front of me seem to indicate, who have taken over a federal building or two in southeastern Oregon. Now, just so you know, this is practically a local story for me. I'm only about, I think, 200 miles or so from there. I'm broadcasting from Oregon myself. What's more, this particular takeover of these federal buildings, and, you know, that's a bit of a misnomer. I heard one person describe it as a glorified highway rest stop building or two, which is exactly what it is, in the middle of, you know, the eastern Oregon sort of sagebrushy high desert country, which is frozen right now. And once those generators that those occupiers of these buildings have run out of fuel, they're going to be mighty cold. But the issues that motivate those folks, or at least the ones that they are publicly stating, the grander issues as opposed to the specific triggers, are things that have been big in this part of the country for a long time. I mean, when I was on the radio here all those years, we talked about it constantly. I covered news stories about this and interviewed people when I was a reporter. I mean, these ideas of the rural Western attitude toward the federal government are pretty widespread. And in fact, the news media has pointed out over and over again that while the locals in southeastern Oregon, it's over by Burns and places like that, while the locals do not approve of these gunmen taking over, you know, these buildings, they do have some sympathy for the way they think. because the way they think is longstanding and widespread here and has quite a bit of support, especially in the rural, more conservative parts of the state. So if you look at the West, it's eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, then you have Montana and Idaho. Nevada has a lot of people who think like this, Utah, Arizona. These are the states where, you know, some people will say it's the militia movement, but in the 1970s, they called it the Sagebrush Rebellion. The situation here in the West is not well understood by the folks in the big city environment of the Northeast, for example, the opinion makers, the people in New York, even the people in Los Angeles. This is a different country out here, and they have different concerns and they have different attitudes. And for those who don't know, the rural folk in the United States have never been overwhelmingly fans of the federal government. They always tend to gravitate much more toward their state and their county officials. And that's normal, isn't it? Right? Those are the people they see and interact with. The federal government, to a lot of people, is a long way away, and they only hear from them when it's something bad as opposed to something good. There's a war and you need to go into the army, something like that. Your tax bill is due. Or in more recent times, we've just designated this bird an endangered species, so we're going to cut the amount of logging you can do in half. There are people who will date the beginning of these problems to the Teddy Roosevelt administration at the turn of the 20th century. Roosevelt, you may recall, was a famous conservationist. The time period in question was right around the time where it was actually like an official thing. The frontier was closed, it was said. So the United States had been totally settled, expanded totally to the borders. The Native American tribes had been totally pacified. And about 5 minutes later, everyone was nostalgic for the old West of, you know, the romance dime novel type thing, right? Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone, our heritage, the whole thing, it has to be preserved. And of course, Teddy Roosevelt was the most romantic man in America, practically. He happened to be president, and he decided he was going to wall off large chunks of the West for preservation and conservation. And listen, let's be honest. I mean, we have places like some of the best national parks in this country, in the world, because he did. At the same time, it created the bone of contention that still motivates people like these people who just took over these, you know, federal buildings in southeastern Oregon. Because what Roosevelt did then was set up sort of a dual interest in the territory. You see, east of the Mississippi, the government owns very little land, very little. But west of the Mississippi, the government owns a ton. The federal government, which of course is, you know, it holds it for the United States population. This is all of our land. But the United States owns, the federal government owns, like more than 80% of Nevada, more than 50% of Oregon. I mean, a lot of these states here, the majority of the land is federal owned, which means they control things like who gets to, you know, mine it, who gets to log it, who gets to drill on it for oil, who gets to graze their cattle on it. And for a very long time, there's been relationships between the government and both mega bazillionaire resource extraction companies, oil, mining, timber, right? Tons of money, but also a lot of hard scrabble people in these areas who also depend on resource extraction, grazing, mining, and all these traditionally, you know, open territory, big sky, Western sorts of concerns. And the people in these rural areas often have an attitude that the people in the other parts of the country who also own these open spaces too get to benefit from them without paying any of the cost. For example, when in the 1970s, the crackdown began on certain kinds of practices for environmental reasons, and others began to impede on people's ability to use the resources. And let's be honest, what that boils down to, that's a money question, right? Whether we're talking about the bazillionaire resource extraction companies who are lobbying because their bottom line is being impacted, or Joe Blow, who happens to work for a timber company, and that's how he keeps his family fed. All these things, you know, have a cost, and the people back east may not feel the cost, but the people here do. And while it's tempting to think we're just talking about, you know, people with a direct interest in, you know, the resource extraction thing, if we're talking about miners, it's the mining company and the miners themselves. But the rest of the community, they're not doing that, except that in most of these places, you can't believe the over-reliance on the resource itself. I mean, here in the Pacific Northwest, I remember visiting here from Los Angeles in the early 1980s, and I was shocked by the one-dimensional nature of the entire region. This was timber country, and everything was reliant upon it. Getting it out of the forest, cutting it, milling it, transforming it into all sorts of different shapes and sizes for export to everywhere. The logging trucks were ever present. I mean, this was the backbone of the entire economy up here. So when changes happen, and sometimes for good environmental reasons, right, benefits everyone all over the country that we preserve these wonderful forests here in the Pacific Northwest, but the people here suffered across the board. Parts of the country were going through a recession in the 1980s, but here it was a depression, in part because the amount of wood that people were normally taking from the forest, and they basically got paid the more they took, they weren't taking anymore. There was less for everyone, and all of a sudden, rules and restrictions were beginning to clamp down on a livelihood here that had funded government services, social safety nets, schools in ways that, you know, maintained a prosperous lifestyle for the people up here, right? And good blue-collar, middle-class jobs. And so when the squeeze came, it affected everybody. And, for example, Oregon schools have never been the same. So the people in especially these rural areas, which are not doing as well as the people in the larger cities that have sort of tried to evolve around that, you know, one crop sort of economy. And in many of these rural areas, they're still feeling the pinch where a generation ago, their parents would have been working at a mill and bringing home a steady paycheck and doing all right. So some resentment is probably natural, I guess. Also, it's worth pointing out that the federal government understands this. I mean, there's something called, you know, safety net payments that they make to timber-dependent counties up here in the Northwest to sort of supplement a little bit for what they lost in timber receipts and whatnot. But that's something that has to be reauthorized all the time, and it's a fraction of what the, you know, money used to be. Now, of course, this is not the specific reason that's cited for why this Southeastern Oregon standoff thing got started. There's some specific thing involving, you know, arson, going back to jail for another time. But the overall arching concerns that the public generally has some sympathy for in large swaths of the rural West concern, you know, these other issues that we were just discussing. The people that actually are leading this standoff in Oregon seem to be people from outside Oregon. The three people who appear to be the ringleaders of this thing, all three of them are the sons of Clive and Bundy. Do you remember that name? Bundy is the Nevada rancher who in 2014 was the cause of a face-off between government agents who were trying to enforce, you know, legal rules concerning cattle and grazing rights, and a bunch of people who showed up to support Bundy. One of my stories describes them as a mix of constitutionalists, gun fanatics, and right-wingers. But they showed up there. There were pictures of some of them posted on a overpass, I think, with sniper rifles. We were told that some of them had military training and were, you know, organizing a prepared defense. But there were also women and children right there in the mix in harm's way. And when the government turned around during the face-off and left, rather than have some disaster happen, this was hailed as some sort of a victory. Now three of that guy's kids are sort of the ringleaders of the situation in Southeastern Oregon. And they have said that they are not going to hurt anybody, but they're going to occupy these buildings, and if anybody tries to remove them, you know, people could get hurt. Now, I should point out that in the East, these same people who've never quite understood this whole question here in the West about why people could even be angry and what their motivation is and what they're thinking, they're calling these people terrorists, which I think is both wrong and unhelpful. Unhelpful because how long have we been talking about how dangerous it is to start expanding that term to a whole bunch of things that it really shouldn't apply to? And I've heard some people say, well, listen, if the Black Lives Matter protesters or the Ferguson protesters, if they're, you know, terrorists, then these people here in Southeastern Oregon are terrorists too. Well, I can go along with that because I don't think that the Ferguson protesters or the Ferguson rioters, even if they're armed, are terrorists. They're lawbreakers, just like these people here in Oregon are lawbreakers too. The Ferguson protesters aren't lawbreakers, but the Ferguson rioters would be. And if they're carrying a gun against, you know, maybe state rules, well, then they broke a gun law. But they're not terrorists. shouldn't apply that label to either one of them. Because think about what happens if you do. And this is where you go back to the story we just did about the people who are coming up with these ideas for quarantining the intellectual contagion that can infect people and make them radicalized so that they do things, you know, that we consider to be terroristic. If these people in southeastern Oregon are terroristic, would you take that idea that we just mentioned about quarantining the radical jihadist ideas of ISIS and apply it to the people in the standoff in Oregon? And this is, you know, as we said, where it gets strange, because the things that motivate them are things like the Constitution and the Bible. If you go look at the things they're, you know, wearing patches with statements on it, and this is the Bible and the Constitution. Now, admittedly, these are things that have prompted all sorts of transformative change and, yes, violence in the past. So if you're going to make an argument that, listen, we know this constitutional type rhetoric can start problems. I mean, look at what the British had to deal with in 1776. It is a little bit of a problem when your country is founded in revolution, right? And you celebrate that once a year. To me, a terrorist is someone who seeks out others to hurt them. These people in Oregon are not seeking out anybody. And the federal government is, let me give them, didn't I give them a pat on the back earlier, Ben, right? Okay, two pats on the back in one show. It must be show number 300. But the way the government is handling this is very smart. Now, they're taking some flack from people who are saying, as we said earlier, that, you know, if these were black folks, or if these were anti-WTO or Occupy Wall Street types, they'd be carpet bombing with pepper spray, right? If they were Islamic folks, they might be dead now. But I think that the government knows that going in there guns a-blazing would create a bunch of martyrs. And I think the government actually learned their lesson. Isn't that a wonderfully bright thing to say from the 1990s and how the government dealt with people in similar situations back then? And they don't want to see that again because it leads to a martyr complex where all of a sudden you make a bunch of people radicalized by how you handle people that are beyond the fringe now. I mean, take, for example, Waco and Ruby Ridge. These are things that are like rallying cries to some anti-government rural folks in the West. And there's more of them than you might think. Do you really want to give those people something else to rally around? And for those who think it's white privilege that the government isn't going in there and just, you know, with tanks and mowing these people down, in the 1990s, it was white folks they were going after. 80 people or something died at Waco. Now, the government will say, well, we didn't do it. No, but it was a guns a-blazing situation. Didn't have to go that way. The same thing in Ruby Ridge, where you have a guy who's admittedly not the kind of guy you want to invite to dinner, kind of a survivalist type. The government tried to link him to the Aryan Nation, and maybe he was, but he hadn't done anything really wrong, and certainly not anything worth shooting his wife and his kid. And, I mean, it was a nasty, nasty situation that the government had to live through hearings and all these other things about. They don't want to do that again. It makes a lot of people angry and maximizes the chances that you'll get another group like these people mad about yet one more, you know, martyr type story that they can rally around. Why risk that? Back off, wait for the generators to run out of gas and these people to freeze, and then they can, you know, surrender with their hands up and, you know, no muss, no fuss. I mean, in one sense, you just want to tell them, why'd you have to bring the guns in the first place? You're going to get arrested anyway. Go sit down, occupy it with no guns, and when they cart you off to jail, you'll only be facing, you know, some sort of glorified trespassing charge instead of some gun charge like you're going to be facing now. You'd have scared a lot fewer people, too. But as I said, I think that a shootout would be something that those people would consider a propaganda plus. So kudos to the government for not falling in that trap, just like they didn't fall into that trap during the Clive and Bundy thing. And I would suggest it's a good lesson for how we often, you know, handle other affairs. I mean, a perfect example would be the law enforcement tendency now to just take down threats as a premium. I mean, I think this idea of backing off would help in a lot of conflict situations, right? Give people time, if you can, to come up with the best solution for everybody. I mean, I think about the 12-year-old in Cleveland who got shot by police officers for brandishing a toy gun. And when you actually look at a case like that, it screams, why did the situation have to unfold that quickly and with so few choices? Couldn't someone have just backed off the same way the government is backing off, by the way, these occupiers in Southeast Oregon, and just give things a chance to unfold, right? So many of these problems seem to happen because we go in guns a-blazing. There's a lot to be said for the value in being able to sit back when you can and allow situations to diffuse, give people a chance to think and time to calm down. If the government had done that at Ruby Ridge, if the government had done that longer at Waco, because they did that at Waco for a while, would the people who have some sort of sympathy with this Sagebrush Rebellion idea still have as much, you know, to fuel their anger as they have now? I think it's smart of the government to not add any more fuel to that fire. And I think it's a wonderful lesson that we could apply in a lot of other situations around the country. The positive value of restraint. The value of restraint is also kind of hard to measure in terms of the benefits. Because how do you measure what bad things didn't happen because you were prudent and rational and restrained all along the way? I mean, the whole time we were sitting here talking about Ruby Ridge and Waco, all I could think of was Timothy McVeigh. Do you remember him? The ex-soldier who blew up the Oklahoma Federal Building in one of the worst terror attacks in American history. He's associated, by the way, he's sort of the radical fringe of these militia types. And, you know, he was also citing things like the Constitution, but he also was perhaps, some of the people he was with certainly were reading things like the Turner Diaries, which are much more like white supremacist stuff. But McVeigh was angry about Waco and Ruby Ridge, right? These were things that helped set him off. If those situations had somehow been diffused and ended peacefully, the same way that I think this Southeastern Oregon thing is going to end, do you ever have a Timothy McVeigh? How do you measure that, though, in terms of political calculation? How do you get a political benefit? How do people give you a pat on the back and say, well done with that rational, prudent decision to defuse those situations so you didn't have a terror attack years later? There's no way to measure that. There's no way to get credit for that. In a political sense, there's no payoff for the politician for being rational and avoiding bad things, right? If you don't topple Saddam Hussein and the entire Middle East isn't the way it is now, how do you get credit for that? Right? You'll still probably be hammered because Saddam Hussein's still in power doing terrible things to his own people and threatening the region. See what I mean? So we not only don't have voters who are going to support a person who expresses their own limitations by saying things like that wouldn't be prudent. I'm not going to run roughshod over the system. That wouldn't be prudent. I think Donald Trump, in my mind's eye, is calling that a loser platform right now. And at the same time, while it's very easy to stand up and take political credit for freeing Iraq and winning, you know, the war over Saddam Hussein, that's a hard event you can put on your resume. A lot harder to say I was the guy who decided not to topple Saddam Hussein and saved that entire region from going over to ISIS. If you are a politician or a campaign manager trying to make a business decision over the best way to run a campaign like that, a platform encouraging restraint, if you wanted to win an election, simply wouldn't be prudent. At the start of today's show, we talked about the specific way the new media has evolved and how no one could have quite seen that coming. And one of the most interesting avenues, I think, of it all is how it pays for itself, right? What's the revenue model that these entities can use to survive? And in the old media, it's different because they're used to really, really high levels of support. And so they're coming down to like what web ads and various things can do. But, you know, people in the new media were kind of starting from zero. And so when we first started getting any money, we were like, hey, you can get some money for this. And the role that advertising has played in the growth of the new media cannot be overstated. And it works differently for different outlets, right? I mean, if you're on a show where you can do 3 to 5 shows a week and put 4 or 5 ads in each show, advertising is paying for that new media product right there, right? That's what underwrites it. Now, obviously, with my release schedule, that's not going to work for us
as the main revenue source. And this, also, I won't do more than one advertisement a show. So that pretty much means for us, it's icing on the cake. It's something we do because we want to, not because we have to. We are listener supported here, as everyone knows. But it allows us to be really choosy about the advertisements that we run. I don't have to do any, and so I only do the ones I like. I only do the ones, you know, that I would actually recommend to you in real life. Because I'm not a salesman, I'm not a good, you know, promoter, as you know. And so I couldn't really fake it very well. For the longest amount of time on this show, 300 episodes into it, Audible has been a supporter. I think they're our first sponsor. I think they're the longest running sponsor. They've run the most sponsorship shows over, you know, our entire length. And I love being able to tell people about books. I'm a book lover. And you know what it's like if you're a book lover. And to be able to tell you about books is something I would do anyway. To be able to tell you about it for Audible is icing on the cake. I like them. I think they're a good company. I think they are providing an outlet for something that, if you look at book sales around the country, it was going down. People aren't reading like they used to, but you know what they are doing? They're listening to books. They're finding new ways to consume that content. Ways that might match a busier, more on-the-go lifestyle, right? That might not lend itself to being able to curl up and focus your undivided attention on the written word, where you might have to cut vegetables in the restaurant you work at, but you could be listening to a book at the same time. Audible's a fantastic place to get one. More than 180,000 titles to choose from. And right now, you can try it out for free. They have a free 30-day trial membership deal where you kind of sign up. You can start downloading your books right then. And it's one of those things where obviously Audible hopes you'll like it and keep coming back for more. I'm reading a book right now that if you want to be reading or listening to the same thing that I'm reading or listening to, Audible has a book that will scare the pants off you, but it's true. It's called The Dead Hand, The Untold Story of the Cold War Arms Race and Its Dangerous Legacy by David E. Hoffman. It's a book about the systems that were put into place, you know, during the Cold War, well, that would just terrify you. You kind of forget what the stakes were. The Dead Hand refers to something that the Kremlin was working on and putting into place that would be able to tell if the Kremlin had been destroyed by an American missile strike and automatically launch a devastating counterstrike anyway. The title itself is worth it, The Dead Hand. I just started it. It looks fantastic. If you want to be reading what I'm reading, check that out. And check it out at Audible. And if you check it out right now at Audible as part of the 30-day free trial, you might be able to listen to it for nothing. Go to audiblepodcast.com/Dan Carlin for your free 30-day trial. And my thanks to Audible for continually putting me in a position where, you know, I could tell people about something I like as much as books.
If you think the show you just heard was worth a dollar, then cough it up. Nonpartisanism doesn't attract the big donors, you know. And hey, you Europeans and Pacific Rim people, yeah, I'm looking at you, Australia. You people are just as susceptible to guilt as everyone else. So put a little shrimp on the barbie for Dan and Ben, because we know where you live. In Australia.
Make sure to do your Amazon.com shopping through the Amazon search window on DanCarlin.com. A buck a show, it's all we ask. And we don't ask too many questions about where the money comes from.
Thanks again for all your buck a show donations. They're the reason we're still here.